Well, this morning I want to talk about a historical subject and bringing us into an understanding of how dispensationalism impacted Baptists in America. Now, that first of all, the history of dispensationalism is quite broad in and of itself. It's a very large topic. The history of dispensationalism in America is a very large topic. The history of dispensationalism among Baptists in America is a very large topic. So I'm going to hit a couple of historical points that I think are very important for us to grasp and understand in somewhat of some of the debate that goes on among dispensationalists and covenant people today. And I'm also, though, wanting to turn us to point our attention to see specifically how Baptists were affected in the South. And then I want to talk just briefly and give you some information about a couple of Northern Baptists or American Baptists that were affected extremely by dispensationalism, who were very, very prominent in the Baptist movement in the Upper Ohio Valley and in Minnesota. So let's begin by dealing with something that I think is a historical issue for dispensationalism. It's a foundational issue, and if we're going to understand our dispensational struggles of today and what we deal with in our conversations with people of today, we have to deal with this one historical issue. When the debate takes place between dispensationalists and anyone that disagrees, the first argument that is brought up and that often is tried or downplayed by dispensationalists is the reality that J.N. Darby is really the founder of dispensationalism. Dispensationalists, most of them will basically agree, but there has been a sharp movement among some dispensationalists, especially those in the modern dispensational crowd, to try to take us back and say, well, you know, dispensationalism was really around long before Darby, and it goes back to the early church fathers. And they tried to make this connection for dispensationalism in a historic sense, going back, tracing a line through Isaac Watts, and saying that because there was not much there in the Dark Ages or the medieval period, that's really because the Roman Catholics had their own Roman Catholic interpretation system through an allegorical basis. And so you see it disappear a little bit. It may be there in some forms, but then we can trace it back to the early church fathers. One of the biggest arguments that's brought forward historically is that there is a perspective of dispensationalism brought by Justin Martyr. And I found this to be a very interesting argument because, you know, as I read the material, a lot of men today who still hold the dispensationalism, they are no longer agreeing that J.N. Darby was the entrance. They're going back to this idea of the church fathers, and they want a historical connection. If they can connect it to the church fathers, then they can connect it to the apostles, so to speak. Well, quite honestly, as I look through this argument, there's one main paper that has been put together by a man by the name of Charles V. Crutchfield in a theological journal, Bibliotheca Sacra. It's been around for a long time. Many of you probably read some articles out of it. But in that journal, he puts forth an argument for a historical basis of dispensationalism that goes back to Justin Martyr and Justin Martyr's use of the word dispensation. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because we had some of that discussion last night. You understand that there's a difference between the dispensationalist definition of a dispensation and using the word dispensation from its meaning in the order of divine management. We certainly would not disagree that God has in certain eras or ages, He has divinely managed and ordered history through the work of His providence. But what happens in this language is they try to go back and take a perspective to say, we have a historical basis for dispensationalism in the early church fathers, and here's where it is. The problem is when you go and read the language of Justin Martyr, it's in his dialogue with Trifo, who, what's interesting about this is he's dialoguing with a Jew. And as you read the dialogue with Trifo, what you come up with is an understanding. If you've got the volumes by Henderson Publishing on the early church fathers, you can go read the dialogue with Trifo and you can really get the argument that it's very clear that what Justin Martyr is talking about has nothing to do with the definition of a separate dispensation in each and every one of these seven ages. Quite frankly, Justin Martyr just puts forward a covenantal position of who Israel is to Trifo. He's asking Trifo, is this salvation only for the Jews? You know, and he's bringing Trifo to an understanding of the gospel. It's a very Christ-centered argument that Justin Martyr gives. And when he brings him to the language of dealing with the Old Testament, he doesn't give him a dispensational argument at all. He doesn't separate anything out. There's no two testaments. There's no two people. There's none of that language at all. He brings together a language that points you directly to the seed in Christ, and that seed is applied to all of salvation throughout all of history. That's a very covenantal perspective, and quite frankly, I just don't think Mr. Crutchfield's argumentation holds up to the weight of the material. I debated on whether to read sections of Martyr to you. I don't think that would be helpful. I just encourage you to go read the dialogue yourself to gain an understanding of it. If you have some questions or if somebody ever questions you on it, you can turn to the dialogue with Trifo and you can really grab hold of it. It really is there. So I don't think you can go back to the early church fathers, because even after Justin Martyr, quite frankly, these men really did hold to a more figurative understanding of some of the language. And quite frankly, it was New Testament based. The way they interpreted the scriptures was looking at what Paul would say, or what Peter would say, or what John would say, and where they used the Old Testament, they would interpret it in that same way. And so they would use an understanding that, yes, there are some literal understandings in the Scripture, but we have a very figurative sense that there is a spiritual Israel, and there has been throughout all of eternity. So the language just really isn't there to support such a historical foundation to say that dispensationalism came about even through the early church fathers. And quite frankly, once you get to the Reformation period, there's just no way to see this, because the Reformation period does found for us the historical grammatical method. It does found for us an understanding of looking at the New Testament as the eyes to the Old. It gives us this basis to say what Paul was quoting here in Old Testament when he says, here it is, I'm telling you that back there is this that I'm talking about. I'm describing it to you. This is exactly what it is. There's no guessing. That's exactly the type of language we get from the Reformers and the Puritans following. Now, the next place that they try to tie into real heavily is to Isaac Watts. Isaac Watts apparently put together six dispensations. When I look at Isaac Watts' language, I didn't spend a lot of time on this, because when you read his hymns, to me it's pretty clear he's not dispensational. It doesn't take very long to read Isaac Watts' hymns and to know he's not dispensational. I don't want to make a big argument, big deal about that. But what language I did read, quite honestly, this is once again a place of misidentification. And quite frankly, I'm finding that through all of dispensational history, there's a lot of misidentification. Horatius Bonner is often tried to, one that is tried to, people try to pull in to the camp of dispensationalism. I think this is where we will see historically the disconnect between what is a dispensationalist and what is a premillennialist.
That's right.
And we have to note that in the historical arguments. Isaac Watts was not a dispensationalist. His dispensations were not divisions where God separately worked in a particular age here, only did it in that age, and then moves along and does the same thing in these separate dispensations and only works in a particular dispensation this way and only that way, the next one and so forth, and separates them into these blocks. He uses his dispensations as a way to bring continuity, and the dispensationalist never brings continuity with the dispensations. It's always discontinuity. When you come to this topic of dispensationalism historically, you have to deal with such issues as some of these men, because they want to grab hold to them to be able to have a basis to say, see, look, we have a historical founding. But I think realistically, it's unfair to do so, because the word dispensation was even used in the Westminster Confession of Faith in the chapter on of God and Covenant in 1643-1644. And if you read that section, it's very clear that... Well, let me just give you this idea. This last statement from that particular confession, this is one of the statements that our confession dropped, or one of the sentences that our confession dropped. But I thought it was interesting to see historically that this word dispensation is used in the section on of God and Covenant, chapter 7 of the Westminster. It says, "There are not, therefore, two covenants of grace differing in substance, but one and the same under various dispensations." Now, their use of the word dispensation there has nothing to do with the way Darbyism would put forth dispensation. They're still claiming a continuity. The various dispensations are, to them, the historical covenants. So, they're not claiming anything new, and they're not bringing about a new form of dispensation. They're just saying, they're using that word in its broadest sense, where the dispensationalist brings about their own definition of that word and hones in on a particular view of what God did in history. Then you gotta see that as we look at the historical perspective, that there's a broad view of dispensation from its broadest understanding in what we read to you from the Oxford English Dictionary last night. And then there's this pointed definition of dispensation that the dispensationalist comes at and says, here's how God works here. He does something different here. He does something different here. Boom, boom, down the line. And I don't think anybody would claim that the Westminster Divines were working out seven different dispensations where God worked differently in all of them and applied no unity to salvation. I don't think that could be done. So, it's a different term to those divines, and it would be a different term to Isaac Watts. When you historically look at dispensationalism in and of itself, you have to take into context what has taken place historically around these men. Remember, Darby's in Ireland, in England. He has a profound impact on England and even somewhat on Scotland. And as this Darbyism is coming about, there's something that led up to it. Darby just didn't come up with this in his own framework. It doesn't matter who we are, we're always impacted by our culture, our country, our surroundings, who we are as men and people. And it impacts us every day. We talked about some of the Zionism issue last night. And that's a part of that. Zionism is real because of something that's going on culturally. And the same thing is true for dispensationalism or Darbyism. There's a context to it. And there's a book by Ernest Sandeen. Now, we wouldn't agree with all of his presuppositions, nor would we agree with some of his conclusions, because Sandeen, at the end of the day, is more of a moderate to a liberal who's trying to deal with fundamentalism in a way to get rid of biblical inerrancy. But quite honestly, I was given this book by a friend of mine, and was a little bit suspect about it at first, but the information in and of itself historically is very important. And when I did talk to Dr. Nettles, this is one of the books he said, you need to read it, because he brings forth arguments for the first time historically that nobody else was bringing forward about dispensationalism. And I said, I asked him about some of those issues theologically, and he said, well, you'll have to wade through that, you know. He said, but don't do away with the material he presents, because the material is very good. And quite honestly, he really sets the context for us that what is taking place to set up Darbyism is a millenarian revival. Now think about this for a moment. When postmillennialism was at its height among the Puritans, what was taking place around them? A great revival. And what's one of the great things in postmillennialism that many of the post-mill people hang on to is that there's this gradual movement that things are getting better toward the coming of Christ. Okay? Well, for the post-mill person in late Reformation, the Puritan age, there were a lot of things getting better. And there was some ebb and flow in there historically in England in the 1600s to where things might get worse for a little while, but then they would get better for a little while, and they'd get worse for a little while, and they kept coming back in this way. Well, after the early portions of the 1700s, things in England just start to go... Every time they turn around, there's another problem. They got problems with Spain. They've got major economic problems they can't solve. I mean, it's falling apart around them. The wheat, everything that's going on in their economy with wheat and barley and all these things, it just tanks. Now, Sandine doesn't bring some of that up, but what he does bring us to is to a point to understand that, think about the French Revolution. And what's taking place with the French Revolution at the time of this millenarian revival? Well, all of a sudden, things are not going well at all. And what is it that you want? You want a new, better kingdom. You want something to work a lot better than what you've got. So England started having... started seeing a movement from a post-mill view to a pre-mill view. It was a millenarian revival. How can we have a kingdom that's actually going to work and do some good things? Well, they're working through that mentally, and they're trying to find it in the Scripture. Well, there are two men that Sandine credits with bringing about the vehemence in the entrance of this millenarian revival in England. It's a man by the name of Lewis Way and Edward Irving. Now, it would be Edward Irving that has the greatest impact on Darby. But what these men were bringing about was not necessarily dispensationalism itself. They were bringing about a millenarian revival, a movement to try to come up with a kingdom, a millennium, that there's going to be a lot better than what we've got here. And their idea of the millennium was seeing that things are going to gradually get worse before they get better. And that was explaining to them what was going on in their own lives. Because things were gradually getting worse. 1776, does that ring a bell? For England, that's huge. They've had major problems with Spain. France has been an actual, a pain to them for quite some time. And the French come along and help the Americans. The Americans are revolting against them. It's just one problem after another that they deal with Napoleon. You get into the War of 1812. You have all of these things going on. Well, oh my goodness, we've got to have something better than this. It's gradually getting worse. Yes, that's right. It's gradually getting worse. And we're going to see the millennium. And we need to understand the premillennial view. And here's this millenarian revival coming on. Well, it's Darby that takes this millenarian revival to new levels. And that's when dispensationalism is born. Just to give you an idea of what's going on in this millenarian revival. Sandine says this, the origin of the second aspect of the 19th century millenarian revival, renewal of interest, is in the state of the Jews. You think about that for a minute. We're seeing a progression here from looking towards this millennium, but what's going to be one of the major doctrines for the dispensationalists is separating out the Jews. And in this millenarian revival, there all of a sudden starts to be this context of Zionism. They're all of a sudden looking to deal with the Jews differently. And that's all coming out of this millenarian revival. Clarence Bass expresses the formation of dispensational theology in England and America in these terms. And it's that these terms is that Lewis Way and Edward Irving open up the door for Darby literally just to take over. And that's what he does. In England, when these arguments start coming forward, he works out his seven dispensations and he puts all of these things together. Well, Darby becomes this spearhead, even to the point that he and F.W. Newton, who is a friend of his at first, and they work together, they end up having major division, and quite frankly, they never reconcile. They work together among the Plymouth Brethren, but they never reconcile over doctrinal issues. He really becomes this spearhead individual. Now, the importance of Darby in his teaching, and we talked about some of the main points of that teaching last night, so I won't go into it. If you weren't here, I'm sorry. I don't know if there'll be a disconnect with any of this or not, but I hope not. But you'll have to see the context that Darby, in and of itself, what he ushers in is something into America that at first it doesn't take off, it doesn't fly. Most of the historical record up until the 1860s in America shows very little dispensational movement. And the reason why is because postmillennialism is still the main major view among most Christians, not all, most Christians, and primarily among most Presbyterians and Baptists in America. In the 1830s and 40s, when this is hot and heavy in the millenarian revival in England, in America this makes no splash at all. But what's interesting to see is that America begins to go through times of real struggle. They're not quite the nation of promise, and everything's not going as great as they think it should or they want it to. And what begins to take place in America? A millenarian revival. Looking for a new understanding of the millennium. Because the post-mill view just isn't cutting it. We have economic problems in America in the 1830s and 1840s. It's a real struggle. The 1850s brings on another issue that leads up to the most prominent, horrible, awful war in American history. I know you've never heard of it. It's called the Civil War. I mean, think about it. All of a sudden, our post-mill view is not so great. This hasn't gotten better. This is the worst it's ever been. We've gone to war with each other. Brother killing brother. Well, all of a sudden, post-millennialism isn't really cutting it. It's not working out the idea of the culture the way it used to. America doesn't seem to be so quite on the rise anymore. Well, this begins a millenarian revival in America, and thus with that millenarian revival in America, then Darbyism begins to, so to speak, seek its teeth in. The cleats start to get in just a little bit into the ground because people are looking for a new understanding of the millennium. Now, this ought to help you in a practical way. At least, well, let me say this. It's helped me in a practical way. I don't know if it'll help you or not, but it's helped me. I have not understood for many, many years why, when talking about covenant theology to a dispensational person, I always end up having to defend my view of the millennium. It always ends up at the millennium. And I'm all the time in the conversation going, no. You're over here. I'm trying to start in Genesis back here. You remember that book? It's an important one. I'm trying to start back here. Let's talk about Genesis, covenants. Let's talk about these things. And every time, it's always at the millennium. It's always about the millennium. I just couldn't figure it out. Well, over the last couple of years of reading some historical works about dispensationalism, especially these last 3 to 4 months, I think I get it now. The millennium is so important because it impacts everyday life to the point that we want to have something we can hold on to and feel good about. And when you take away somebody's basis and structure, they may not understand the structure and the foundation of how they get to dispensational premillennialism, but they get the end part. And the end part gives them comfort. And when you take away somebody's security blanket, it's bad news. That's why it matters. But you also have to see historically, there's a connection there that the reason this came about was because people's security blanket was being rocked by providence. The post-mill view was great and wonderful while everything was going good. When things weren't going so well and there wasn't an explanation in how to deal with it and what this meant for the future and for the end of our lives, all of a sudden we got to look for something else. After the Civil War, things are not any better in the South. Think about what the South went through. Think about the economic struggles of the whole nation. From 1870 to 1900, the nation is in a great economic struggle. So you have the South who's coming out of the Civil War. Reconstruction is just horrible on the economy. People are struggling. That's not a political statement. I'm not trying to say the South needs to be, needs to rise again. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the reality of the situation. Economically, it was bad. But the rest of the country wasn't any better, really. It was wonderful and great. In reality, Jekyll Island was the place that there was the greatest version of wealth, but it was because most of the Northeasterners who had money were coming down here and this was their playground. Well, people are looking around and going, well, what's happening? Well, they need a new view. Darbyism starts to give them a place to have this new view to figure out what's going on and why things are so bad. And this hits Baptists. It hits Baptists in their doctrine, because think about pastorally what pastors are starting to go through. They're having to answer questions about why are things so awful. Well, as a pastor, don't you want to be able to answer that question? Now, covenant theology, the doctrines of grace, a firm understanding of the sovereignty of God, gives us a place to answer those questions, doesn't it? But this security blanket of the post-mill view is just not what it used to be, and so people start to latch on. And it's not in the seminaries. It's very interesting, as Baptist, what takes place is not happening in the seminaries. So far, I've been able to see up to 1887, the seminaries were still teaching covenant theology and a post-mill view. James Leo Garrett even goes as far as to say that some of these Baptist men were still getting the post-mill view in seminary even up to 1905 to 1920. What you're seeing is a cultural rise of a doctrine. And it impacts Baptists in a very interesting way. Now, we could talk a lot about different figures that are dispensationalist. And, we could go through lists of names all over the United States historically. But to pare some of this down and to be able to give you some idea of the historical formations of dispensationalism among Baptists, I'm focusing it mostly how it came into Baptists in the South especially Southern Baptists. One of the most controversial figures in Southern Baptist life is a man named J.R. Graves. Some of you may have heard of him. J.R. Graves is the father of landmarkism among Southern Baptists. He is the father of landmarkism. If you don't know what landmarkism is, I won't take a lot of time to describe it, but landmarkism in and of its essence is basically to say only the Baptists in their Baptist ecclesiology are the true churches. Okay? And he took it as far as to say, we're going to question anyone who's been baptized outside of a Baptist church by a Presbyterian minister. We're going to question who they are as far as a Christian. And furthermore, even questioned later down the road, should we even have Presbyterian ministers in the pulpits of Baptist churches since they were baptized in non-Baptist churches that really aren't churches? Are they ever really ministers? It goes that far. And I think there are some points for debate, and we certainly at some point can have them. And Baptist churches still have them today. You'll note among ARMCA churches and among some of our churches that I bet there would still be some of those debates about the issue of baptism and who you allow to be a member of your church and who you don't. Would you allow a Presbyterian to be a member of your church without rebaptizing them? There would be a debate. May not in this room. I think there might be, but I know among ARMCA churches there would be. So you've got some of these debates still lingering. But what you will see with J.R. Graves is that from the very beginning, he's a very independent sort. He's left fatherless at a young age. He's having to take on the reality of building up his own home and bringing money home to his family. So he's not very well educated. So what does he do? He self-educates himself. I mean, just totally just immerses himself in education and gets qualified to be a teacher by self-education. Moves his family, including his own mother, from Vermont all the way down to Ohio. Now what's interesting though, before he left Vermont, he grew up in a congregational church and he was baptized at the age of 15 into the Baptist church because he'd been converted. So he has a congregational background, he moves to a Baptist setting, he educates himself, he moves south to Ohio to become a teacher. All of this is just, I mean, you got to recognize the moxie of a man like this. We're not talking about he got in his car and drove to Ohio from Vermont. I mean, we're talking about a man who at the age of, 18 to 20, literally is the American picture of tightening up his bootstraps and getting her done. So he's got this independent moxie about him, and he's going to just take these things on. He's taken on the Baptist faith. He moves down to Ohio, and within 2 years, there's another school in Kentucky that says, oh, no, we need your services. He says, great. So he moves to Kentucky. He gets into Kentucky. As he moves into Kentucky, he kind of takes over things there with this church. He comes under this Mount Freedom Church and all of their theology, and there's a slight entrance there of this landmarkism and a slight entrance there of dispensationalism. Just very minuscule. But what takes place now will affect Baptists forever. J.R. Graves moves to the state of Tennessee. He comes in contact with a man by the name of R.B.C. Howell. R.B.C. Howell is hugely important to Baptists. At the time, he was the editor of the Tennessee Baptist paper. Eventually, that paper would be the largest circulated paper in the South. The largest circulated Christian paper in the South. By 1859, there was over 13,000 subscribers. When you think about that, the next step is that R.B.C. Howell leaves as the editor and J.R. Graves becomes the editor. He's already adopted landmarkism full force by 1848 when he is the editor of this paper. And he's on the road to adopting pieces of dispensationalism. He continues as the editor of this paper all the way into the 1870s. But note this, he becomes a major publisher himself. He owns several publishing companies, and he begins to distribute many, many tracts and publications throughout the southeastern United States. Now, why would that be crucial? Well, it's crucial for several reasons. And James Leo Garrett helps us to understand some of this. When you think about the ideas that are being put forth, it's Graves in and of himself that single-handedly brings this to bear. Let me just read a section to you. Very, very small section here. J.R. Graves, the landmarker, at least during the latter part of his life, embraced dispensationalism. Such views were expressed quite often in Graves' papers, The Baptist, and in three books published after 1880. Now, one of the books he published was on Christ and the Seven Dispensations. Just to give you an idea. Among the authors that seemingly influenced Graves toward dispensationalism, according to Danny E. Howe, were Adoniram Judson Frost, that's a different guy, Joseph Augustus Sice, and David Nevins Lord. He says, there is no evidence that Graves was acquainted with or utilized the writings of Darby. Now that statement's interesting. He didn't utilize the exact arguments of Darby or writings of Darby, but listen to what he says next. By 1859, Graves seems to have embraced premillennialism, but not dispensationalism. By 1867, he was teaching the Great Tribulation. By 1874, a different distant destiny for Israel in the flesh and Israel in the spirit. By 1878, the restoration of Jews to Palestine, and by 1883, the pre-tribulational rapture of the pure saints. You see a progression there? He's taking on dispensational doctrine over a period of about 18 years. And at the same time, he's one of the largest publishers and writers sending out material all over the Southeast. James R. Graves is the connection to see how we have dispensationalism among Baptists in the South. He was so prominent. He ran different committees in the SBC. R.B.C. Howell at one point embraced him, and then later in life he turned around and said, I'm not sure about this guy. Kurt and I had this conversation the other night. R.B.C. Howell became one of the greatest opponents of landmarkism. But what was interesting is that R.B.C. Howell and some of these other men were not able to squelch the doctrine of this man in any shape, form, or fashion. And the reason I think so is because it's not just an issue of something this man wanted to teach. He was giving people something that culturally they wanted to grab hold of. Everything was so awful. They were moving away from this post-mill view, and they wanted to latch onto this premillennialism. Well, now all of a sudden he's teaching these other things. But what people don't realize, now, today, as they try to divorce from some of these other teachings of dispensationalism, the only reason you have the doctrine of the secret rapture and the tribulation is because of the setup of dispensationalism itself. All of the separate dispensations lead to this. The age of grace that dispensationalism talks about, it has to have an answer and a way out. Think about it. historically, these men were now in a position that they had to bring about a new view of the millennium to deal with the culture. But once they brought about that new view of the millennium, what was their way out? How did they explain Israel? How did they explain the two people of God not being together? How were they going to come together finally in the end? We're looking for any straw we can grab hold of. Well, many start to teach Revelation 4. When John is caught up, well, this is when the church is caught up. Sounds kind of figurative, doesn't it? They have to look for these answers because of their system. But that system explains everything else, and it founds the basis for how they come about this new view of the millennium. And the culture is willing to grab hold of it because everything around them is falling apart. J.R. Graves becomes a figure that we can look at and see. And the thing I like about James Leo Garrett's book is every one of those statements I read to you, he has them footnoted as to exactly where he saw them, exactly where he read them. And those men, I went back and checked some of his footnotes, those men give you primary sources and understandings. I bought J.R. Graves' book on the seven dispensations, and quite frankly, it's just as dispensational as it can be. Now, he's not the exact dispensationalist of Darby. And James Leo Garrett notes this as well. He doesn't exactly explain the seven dispensations just like Darby does, but it's so close that he works out a lot of the same conclusions. And that's how you read, he's got this two-view Israel in the church, a physical Israel, a spiritual Israel. He's got these two views that he's working out. Well, how does he work it out? Everything becomes physical for him. He's got to work out the Jews getting back to Palestine. He's got to deal with all of these issues that he comes about through saying, oh, I'm separating the people of God. Well, J.R. Graves does that over time, and when he does that over time, and because he's so involved in the publishing that's going out throughout the South, he begins to have an influence on people. These tracts are circulated all over. Thousands and thousands of them are circulated all over the Southeast, and people are just grabbing hold. Now, many of you have heard of John R. Rice. You know who he is, and you know W.A. Criswell. That Criswell was a premillennial dispensationalist. You know, we could go into some other names. But where is the connection from J.R. Graves to John R. Rice? How does it continue to move? Because Graves dies in 1893. And by 1893, dispensationalism is starting to really take a foothold in Baptist life in America, and especially in the South. Well, James Leo Garrett points us to a man by the name of John Franklin Norris, who's quite an interesting figure. He has an unconverted father, a converted mother, raised for just a couple of years in Dadeville, Alabama, and then moves to Texas. While he's in Texas, he is converted not too long after he was shot by a man who was trying to shoot his father. He took a bullet literally for his dad. He was converted after that, ordained or licensed into the ministry, as the Baptists would say. And then he went off to seminary in 1905, and he went to Southern Seminary in 1905. Norris later admits that all of his professors were post-mill. But Norris, when he goes back to pastor in Texas, he takes on these dispensational pre-mill views because it deals with the culture he's in. The economy in Texas is absolutely going down the drain. The cattle industry is folding around him. And providentially, he begins to usher in these views into his life. But what you want to note about Norris is he's that independent sort as well, and he's a controversial figure. Both these men, J.R. Graves and John Franklin Norris, are always looking for the next controversy. I found that very interesting, that what quite frankly is ushered into Baptist history as a separation from the biblical orthodox gospel is brought in by two controversial men who literally, around every corner, are linked to just about every controversy in their area. Now, John R. Graves was more regional and more widely known. Norris was more widely known at first just in the Texas area that he was in Dallas and Fort Worth. But eventually, he goes against Southern Baptists so hard that the local association excludes him and the Southern Baptist Convention excludes him. And he moves into this non-denominational dispensational movement that you see more like what Moody was involved in. D.L. Moody. This man was so involved in coming up with these issues and working them out that he's constantly fighting with somebody, that eventually he runs himself out of any church at all, just about, except for the one where people will follow him alone and nothing else. These two men really are what I call the starter logs for the fire of dispensationalism among Baptists in the South. And we have to recognize that their influence is so wide that they are taking on a mentality that has grown into something that, quite frankly, among most Baptists today, they wouldn't even question whether dispensationalism was true or not. I mean, you recognize we are the plain oddity. We are strange, weird people to call ourselves Baptists. And literally, not any longer than 150 years ago, we would have been the mainstream. That's how quick this is really compiled. Literally from about 1888 to the present day, this fire of dispensationalism just took off. Now there's two Northern Baptist figures that we need to make note of, and one is a man by the name of John Roach Straighten. Some of you have heard of him. And then another man is a man by the name of William B. Riley. Both of these men were fairly controversial, but they didn't seem to be quite as controversial as Graves and Norris. But they were controversial in the sense that they were fighting against something that was extremely important to them, and that was they were taking on evolutionism. They were dispensationalists. They were avid dispensationalists and premillennialists, but their main fight was against evolutionism. That's why they went after the hard literalism, was to go against Darwinian thought. They were trying to win the Baptist Church back from liberalism. William B. Riley, he lived all the way up until the late 1840s, I think about 1848. And, I mean, prolific writer, but he went after evolutionism with every ounce of his being. And he is a man that I think if you read some things about him, you could appreciate him. And you could appreciate his desire to protect the Scriptures. But unfortunately, that protection led him to some places in dispensationalism that impacted Minnesota to the point that dispensationalism took over Minnesota within about 25 years. And John Roach Straighten was very similar in that fact, that the Ohio Valley, the upper Ohio Valley, was never the same after he took on dispensationalism and fought against evolutionism. The thing about Straton is that he was so desirous to deal with these issues that he literally went and preached anywhere he could all over the United States. He was even going to go down to the Scopes trial, and at the last minute, it was over, and he didn't get to go and didn't get to take part. He even tried to debate the men from the Scopes trial at a later date, and they wouldn't have anything to do with him. He wanted to defeat evolutionism so bad, but he did it at a great cost, because his acceptance of dispensationalism and that hard literalism led him down some roads that every church that he went into, he brought that dispensationalism. And because he was such a nationally known figure against evolutionism, well, you know, people would say, and it happens today, well, John Roach Straton said it. I mean, think about how things are accepted today because a big figure says it. You've run across it in your own churches. I've always been amazed. I can say something from the pulpit and somebody will go, well, you know what? I read so-and-so. He said that. You must be right because he said it. It doesn't have anything to do with the text. It's because so-and-so said it, you know. Or they come back and say, well, so-and-so didn't say that. I'm not sure about it. Okay. You know, I mean, what do you say? Okay. Well, the same thing's happening then. This takeover of dispensational thought, and it's running through. The main connection, though, I want you to see is this desire for this millenarian revival. I think if you'll see that in England and you'll see that in America, you'll understand the reasons why dispensationalism took off. There's a real issue that's taking place in America, in the American life, and in the American economy, among American people, and they're not able quite to answer it anymore the way they wanted it answered. It also goes to show that somewhere along the line, preaching in churches suffered because men were no longer preaching the sovereignty of God from the text and preaching covenant theology the way that it should have been preached. Because what you'll find with John Franklin Norris, he moved away from preaching any text. By the end of his career, I mean, he was in Charismania. He was off the chart in places in Texas. I mean, he had ushered in all kind of mysticism and things of that nature. I mean, so you have to question at some point, historically, did men stop preaching the texts properly? Did they stop going to the text and expositing the text for their people to bring them to the point of seeing the necessity of viewing God from a biblical perspective and not just getting caught up in a millenarian revival? Because really, at the end of the day, a millenarian revival, that's just a type of emotionalism. You'll remember a few years ago that in Texas there were the Brownsville revivals. But if you go and read some of the documentation about that, it has everything to do with the millennium. It's a type of millenarian revival. So a millenarian revival in and of itself ushers in a pure emotionalism apart from the Scripture. And I think it's a good caution to us to take into consideration being careful that we stay close to the text. We're Christ-centered in our preaching, staying close to the text, preaching Christ from all of the Scripture, not just one testament, all of the Scripture, and making sure that we understand that what we bring into our people, it could have an impact which we never intend. I don't know that J.R. Graves intended some of those things. Unintended consequences. And we have to think through them. So those are my thoughts there from a historical standpoint.